My friends are always telling me that I'm old-fashioned, that I'm out of date and born too late to ever catch on. But maybe that's because they can't imagine the love of an old-fashioned girl.
Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. You are listening to the world radio premiere of a re-release of an album. I'm going to call it an album. Artistic Hair came out by Steve Goodman in 1983, and a wonderful company out of God knows where, working with the Goodman estate, has reissued two of Steve's old albums. These are the first two albums, this one and can't remember the name of the other one that he did on Red Robin, which were the last recordings he ever made. And I think it's really appropriate to have this kind of music on because my two guests are, to my mind, on a level of Chicago artist and artistry with Steve Goodman, Jamie Arell, and John Devins. Hi.
Hello, Rick. How are you?
Tell me for a second. I mean, I'm writing about Steve, the re-release of these CDs, and I just thought, what a wonderful thing. You know, Steve died in 1984 at 36, one of the great tragic deaths on the artistic scene here. And I just was so taken with the fact that they're re-releasing two of his last CDs with 17 new bonus tracks. You guys knew Steve.
I knew him through people. I didn't know him personally.
But as an artist, though.
Absolutely. And yeah.
Sure. Yeah. We've seen him many times.
One of the things you think to yourself, you know, my God, had he lived for these 30-some years, you know, his old pal John Prine is now getting these great accolades, deservedly so, as one of the greatest songwriters in the history of American folk music and American music. It's a great thing. You two have been such an intimate part of the Chicago artistic community. You are going to have a benefit concert Saturday at the great Givens Castle with such other, you know, one of Steve's great collaborators was Michael Smith.
Right.
Wrote one of Steve's most famous song was, yes, City of New Orleans. But what was his second most? What do you think his second most?
Was it the Dutchman?
Oh, had, yeah, to be. Sure. This is just a wild guess, yeah, on my part. Larry Gray, Ann Hills, your wife, John. You've been doing this at Givens Castle and the Heritage Gallery for, I don't know, the last couple.
This is our second and a half year, really.
Is it really?
Yeah.
How did I miss all that? Because I've written about it. I'm your official biographer, am I not?
You are. Yeah. Yes, you are. And I appreciate that very much.
It's my pleasure. Talk about why you started doing this, John. I mean, you had for a while one of the, to my mind, the sort of the Old Town School of Folk Music South on 103rd Street, and it was the World Folk Music Company, and it was not easy down there, was it?
No, it was not easy, but we did quite well, I think. We were open for 13 years, and I'm doing this again because I love bringing in the artists that I'm bringing in.
Yeah.
We have the Beverly Arts Center, and which is a great place.
Absolutely.
But they don't have anything for 125 seats.
Right.
They're a 400 seat venue.
Well, and you two, one of the last times I did a lengthy interview with the two of you was when you were putting on some shows and getting a little place ready in the South Loop. Remember that, Jamie?
I do. That was quite a while ago.
It was. Well, you know, we're all old. I'm old now. That's all I can tell you. What was that place?
Well, that was a venture that John got involved in, kind of coming out of world music. And I think it was a little early down there still, don't you think, that area for
perhaps
nightlife kind of thing. But I had the pleasure, and I was at one of the big nights down in World Folk, Eddie Holstein and you were there. It was one of those great nights, and I had the pleasure of performing down there for John, and Michael, of course, has an Ann Hills who's on the bill with us. you know, we've done quite a bit down there with John. This is my first time at the castle, so I'm
excited
really? About that. But I've been hearing
you've
about
been
it
in the. You, but
I been, have not been in.
You
it.
Have never been in
no.
the castle, John. Explain. I could do it too, but I'd rather have you explain. It is the only castle in Chicago.
The only castle in Chicago, and it's haunted. I must tell you before you get in there.
Aren't they all? Aren't they all?
My granddaughter would love that.
Yes, well, it's been around for a long time. Givens is a fellow who came over from Ireland, and he wanted to build a home that reminded him of Ireland.
Yeah.
So he got some Joliet limestone, and he put this thing together. And now the turrets are in real bad shape, so we have to fix those things up.
See, Jamie, you're doing a benefit for this place, and you've never been
am,
in there. And you know what a turret is, though, right?
Sort oh, do
of.
I?
Yeah, I bet you do. But John, you decided some time ago to put on concerts, small kind of intimate concerts at the Heritage Gallery, which was founded by Jack Simmerling and still run by his daughter Vicky, just east of Givens Castle. Small intimate concerts there and intimate concerts at the Givens Castle. You've been on the show before and you talked about this, but talk about it again because now we have a large summer audience out there. Why, John? I think, and I'm going to speak for you, I think it's because your love of Chicago performers. Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're right. My love of these people, it's incredible. You know, I grew up, these are all my heroes.
Yeah, I know.
Who have played for me, especially Michael Smith, who is one of the greatest songwriters in the English language.
No question.
And he's a phenomenal entertainer, and I have to have him back every year. My audience would be wondering what I was doing.
What happened? You guys have a fight? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm excited to have him back, as well as Larry Gray, and I'm working on some others. We haven't really finished getting everybody together, but I'm reaching out to Charles Heath, the great jazz drummer.
The whole notion of having a benefit concert, you've been doing these concerts with most of the money going to the castle, but the notion of a benefit concert, I had the wonderful guy Earl Magginson on, who had written a book about Givens Castle. It needs help, and it's a why do you think, without you know, burning bridges or insulting people, why do you think the Beverly community has not, why there has not been an outpouring? I mean, they've got to have some rich commodities brokers down there who could write a check to fix Givens Castle.
I think some of the people are starting to step up.
Oh, good, good, good.
They were just awarded a $300,000 grant from the state of Illinois.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
That funding
has come through.
And, that was,
and you know, just to weigh in as a performer connected in the Beverly community, folks who know the song The Dutchman know that the Irish claim it as a folk song, and that's Michael's song.
That's right.
And Beverly's, you know, a huge community of Irish-American history in Chicago. It's where Beverly's where I played my first gig out of college, was at the library there, doing a set of Irish songs down in Beverly. And so this idea for our aspect of the benefit actually came from Ann Hills, who was in town, and she comes to visit me. She's coming into town next weekend and getting a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Woodstock Folk Festival on Sunday. So she said, while I'm in town, what if the three of us, and then Larry's an old friend of hers as well, did a benefit for John in the series, because we really want to see it succeed, and we figured that spillover with some publicity would help kind of revive the idea of the folk and jazz concerts that John and Julia produced down there. So that's where it came from, our side of things.
And well, great torch singers like Jamie O'Reilly.
You call her a torch singer now, do you, Jack?
Nice.
She can do it all.
I'm going to keep them on for another half hour. I'm here with my great friends, John Devins and Jamie O'Reilly. They are together orchestrating this benefit concert next Saturday, this coming Saturday at 7 o'clock at Givens Castle, which is at 103rd and Longwood Drive. You cannot miss it. If you are near 103rd and Longwood Drive and you miss the Givens Castle, don't go to the concert. That's what I say. We'll be back after a short little break. Thank you.
a PhD in physics, and she went to town to look for some work. Every place she applied, Saved by the Bell, they told her she was qualified to be a secretary or a clerk.
And that is, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Steve Goodman. There are two CDs, new CDs, being released momentarily. I've written about them for the Tuesday Chicago Tribune. You can access those stories online tomorrow. It's just so nice to hear him again. And he fits into this unbelievable sort of pantheon of great Chicago musicians, which include my guests, John Devins and Jamie O'Reilly. It is an amazing thing to me, you two, and you're having a benefit concert Saturday at the Givens Castle with such other people as your wife, John, Ann Hills, Larry Gray, and Michael Smith. It sometimes, and it takes something like this new CD to punctuate it for me, about the astonishing level of talent in this town.
Always has been. Always has been. As far back as I can remember, when a lot of my friends were listening to and going to see Frank Zappa and Cream,
yeah,
I was coming down here to Rush Street, to the showcase, to the Earls.
Sure. And Jamie, you too. I mean, you were up in the far reaches of the northern or the northern suburbs. But
I think for me, my entry was really through Bob Gibson, coming out of college at DePaul in the School of Music there, having studied classical, but being right on Lincoln Avenue and having access to the clubs there. So for me, it was Holstein's and Orphans in that era, a little later. But Bob, I'd heard of him, and I spoke with him, and he booked me right away at his place called Hobson's Choice.
Sure.
And that's where I first heard Michael play bass for Bob and met Ann and everybody and Stuart Rosenberg and that scene. But Bob was real generous with us. Me and my band was Jamie O'Reilly and the Rogues, and he gave my ex-husband the lead in his musical about Carl Sandburg. So then I started piecing it all together, the scene. And the scene, I think, what is it about Chicago? Well, it's a generous town in terms of the arts, and artists help each other.
No question.
And that makes a big difference. So the collaborations are strong. People want to see each other succeed. The pie is small, so it gets carved up in little pieces, and that's why, the house concert and the salon-type things I do are kind of on the rise for people of a certain age, because you get an intimate scene like you might have remembered from your youth, but you're not paying downtown prices. So that's one of the aspects, I think.
John, this must be, and I can only imagine what your conversations are like with people who have come to the Heritage, Vicki Simmerling's Heritage Gallery, and the concerts at the Givens Castle, which is a half block west of the Heritage Gallery, while you've been putting on this concert series over the last 2 years. You must hear a variation of that same thing, don't you?
I certainly do. And the feedback I've gotten from the artists is that they love working these concerts, because it's so, the audience is so friendly and the venue is so friendly toward them. They really feel the respect.
What's the difference in the venue size? I know the Heritage Gallery shows are slightly smaller.
The problem, we're not going to be able to do Heritage Gallery.
You've outgrown Heritage Gallery.
Lawyers, basically.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Yeah. That's partly where this idea came in, was to bring a new kind of face to the specificness of the castle so John could revive the bigger room.
How many people can the castle sit?
We've gotten over 125 in there, but I won't want to make a habit of it.
Why is that?
It gets
because they get unruly.
It gets a little crowded.
Really?
Yes.
Well, have you given any thought? I mean, I have to believe that this concert, upcoming concert on Saturday, with you, Jamie, with you, John, with your wife, John, with Ann Hills, Larry Gray, Michael Smith, and perhaps some others. Have you had to turn people away yet?
No, not, well, I've turned people away at our concert series, yes. But not for this. There's still tickets available.
You can go to heritagecastleconcerts.org.
Here is the website.
You have a website now. Okay.
Yes. concerts@thecastle.org.
concertsatthecastle.org. See, one of the great things about folk musicians in this town is they are not, as I am not, internet savvy. I'll tell you one very quick story. I had Fred Holstein on. Someone had reissued for Fred a gathering, like a double CD of Fred Holstein songs, and it was a remarkable, the late Fred Holstein, a remarkable gathering of his stuff. And he's on the radio with me, and I'm saying, Fred, this is just, played a lot of songs. We talked a lot about his career, about his brothers, Eddie and Alan. And I said, Fred, now you have, people can order this at your website, right? No, Rick, I don't got no website. What do you mean? I go, well, the website where people can go on the computer and order them. He goes, no, I don't have anything like that. And I go, yeah, but I think you do. Someone had sent me this link to fredholstein.com. And Fred gets this look on his face. He goes, oh, yeah, Rick, I'm sorry. I got a website, that fredholstein.com. What I don't got is a computer. Yeah. And I thought that is like the definition, my loving definition of Fred Holstein, the folk singer. So you guys haven't done any rehearsals for this Saturday show. It's just going to be kind of, you know.
It's going to be organic.
Like a hoot nanny, as they used to call them.
We're going to do some trade-offs on songs. And, you know, Julia and John, Ann and I talked about putting something together. She's going to write a new verse for this horrible era that we're in terms of the immigration situation, for the great Phil
Yes,
Oaks
there's
song.
Always a political element yes. to any folk concert that goes on.
We're going to do There But
time.
For Fortune, Phil
neat.
Oaks' great song, and she's going to write a new verse for it. And I'm going to tell John about that later.
Now, Jamie, I know you live in many ways to perform. John, is that true of you too, because you have become this kind of impresario and entrepreneur? Do you still, I mean, is performing your great love?
Well, when I'm performing, it is. Before I perform, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And my wife will attest to this. I'm always bemoaning the fact that I have to go out and work before we go. So many problems, so many things you got to do, but I get there and I love it. And afterwards, I feel like a million bucks, you know, and then the cycle starts again.
Yeah. Now, this thing is obviously, I know it runs for a little while longer this year, but it's been so successful. Has it given you the notion that, oh my goodness, maybe I could start a venue again with regular performances?
Well, the castle has always been in my eye.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like World Folk Music Company, that building was always in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
Going through the neighborhood. This is the place. And then all of a sudden it opened up and we were happy to get it.
Yeah.
And the castle I've been thinking about for years. I thought, man, this would be a wonderful. Julie and I were married in the castle.
Oh my goodness.
And so, Jamie, well, this is great. And Jamie's never been in the castle.
For this one.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have
did
fun
you not know
with
that?
I did not know that part. No.
Yeah, I see. Even I knew that. Even I knew that with my utter lack of any kind of performance
skills. And it came. It's true. It's just a wonderful place to see a show. It's very intimate and
oh, there's no question. But the other thing about it, it is unique.
Absolutely.
It is not kind of unique. It is not sort of unique. It is unique. There is no other building like that I have ever seen in the city of Chicago or, frankly, the Chicago suburbs where I'm loath to go. I will be keeping these two on after the news to further kind of help promote what is one of the events of the summer. Saturday, 7 o'clock, Givens Castle. John, his wife Julia, Ann Hills, Larry Gray, Jamie O'Reilly, Michael Smith, and Lord knows who else. Maybe you just play like a couple of these Steve Goodman songs off the CD. We'll be back after the news.
But it's a jump. It's a little jump tune. So it goes. If I say let's give a party, you go. Let's give a party. Give it right here.
Right here.
You buy the whiskey.
I'll buy the beer.
Good.
Let's give a party.
Let's give a party.
Give it on me.
Give it on me.
I can't make it.
I can't make it.
I'm drunk, you see.
I'm drunk, you see.
Oh, me.
Oh, me.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
Oh, you.
Oh, you.
Zoo, zoo, zoo.
Zoo, zoo, zoo.
I can't dance.
I can't.
Scared to take a chance.
That is the one and only Steve Goodman from a new CD, a sort of remastered, reworked with some bonus tracks CD. Two of them are coming out later this week. I've written about them for Tuesday's Tribune, and it fits so perfectly to play it here because I have such endless respect for the musicians who are nurtured by the Chicago scene. Those include my guests, Jamie O'Reilly and John Devins. They will be part of a benefit concert Saturday at 7 o'clock at Givens Castle, a unique Chicago structure. I wanted to almost say more unique. You cannot use an adjective with unique. And one of the great concert venues in the world.
Yes.
I would have to say. John, what is the website to order tickets?
Concertsatthecastle.org.
That is also one of the coolest websites I've ever heard of, concertsatthecastle.org.
And you know, now, I have everything on my brand spanking new website, jamieo'reilly.com.
I know.
Including Google Maps for all these events that we're mentioning, and many pages dedicated to Michael Smith and his music, and all of our recordings are there now. So I'm no longer a, you know, neophyte at building websites.
I know. And I want to mark the recent passing of your mom, who's quite a woman.
Thank you for what you said about her. Well, Winifred was my name.
Yes, yeah. Winnie, as they called her. And how many kids did she raise?
14.
That's sainthood somehow. Mm-hmm. Sainthood. Why did your redone website is really cool.
Thank you.
Why? Never having done any kind of website, I guess, why would you redo a website?
Well, I decided I wanted to rebrand myself now, and when the matriarch passes and you're from a performance family, there's something you need to talk to yourself about, and I did. You know, who are you now? My mother was a singer, and I had been using, as an activist, I'd been using this kind of role as a voice for the soul of the city, for Chicago, for my activism years.
Sure.
And I said, you know, done that since you were 16, and for 10 years straight I did a lot of advising and coaching of others, and I decided to make it about me now and about my singing and my writing. And you and I talked about it in February, and I was
absolutely
getting ready to do it.
Yep.
And then when my mom passed away, I stepped up, and so I'm trying to keep the blog's pretty steady, and I'm giving background on Chicago and being an artist in Chicago. And one of my inspirations is Willa Cather and her Song of the Lark book, which
sure
was about a singer coming to Chicago near the Art Institute, which is where my first job was. I worked at a law firm in the late 70s before I decided to go to DePaul. So I'm looking at it, you know, inspired by you and your work about identifying Chicago and what charges us forward, and making it about what is a voice in Chicago, the stories of Chicago, the neighborhoods. And that's partly why I'm interested in working with John and Beverly, is to bring focus to the different arts in the different neighborhoods, but through my own stories and the stories of my pals.
That's great. I love the new website, jamieo'reilly.com. John, how did you first meet Jamie? I don't know this.
Booking Michael. Yeah.
I believe.
Right. And the fact that John and Julia play Irish music and Irish folk music, and we have very similar tastes. And
have you performed with them? You must have at some
just
point.
Just at, I think, at the benefit that we did many years ago.
We will this Saturday night.
Yes, we will.
What do you do, John? I'm really curious. What do you do on St. Patrick's Day?
I stay as far away from the South Side as I possibly can.
Get me off Western Avenue. That's nonsense.
Well, used to, you know, there was a time when we actually did 7 gigs a day.
No.
And I'm sure Jamie has as well.
I did 5. I remember that.
Sometimes we'd start off at a little bar near the Cook County Jail.
Oh, dear.
And we'd go from there. You know,
it was a ball. Yeah.
But I'm telling you, man, I'm not doing the bar scene anymore.
You know what I did down here was USA Today, right near here. USA Today used to do a big St. Patrick's Day party. We'd get booked for that one. And so then the writers, because Dan Tucker, you know, my uncle, who worked at the Trib, he would bring his pals out. And so we would perform kind of for their guests, and then the journalists who just wanted to hang out with Dan's pals on St. Patrick's Day would come
and
down
and get free drinks. In the great hope, like all journalists, of getting free drinks.
And they did.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
They did. Now, tell me again. I mean, I want to totally promote this show next Saturday. It's at 7 o'clock. Not next Saturday. It's this coming Saturday at Givens Castle. You performers are going to get up there and sort of be like, okay, John, what do you want to play? Jamie, what do you want to play? I mean,
right.
there is something to be said joyfully for that kind of spontaneity, I think.
Well, and the great thing is, I think the people that are involved, and Larry's certainly done quite a bit down there with John, and I collaborate with Ann and Michael quite a bit, is spontaneity to us is these are things you do like falling off the log. You know, they're
right.
not, it's not, you know, cold readings of something that's unrehearsed. It's
of course, yeah.
It's a dynamic we're accustomed to doing. We'll have mini solo sets and then we'll share. And you know, the idea is to be inclusive. To show the range of what John and Julie are potentially are going to be programming there. I think.
You excited about that? You said that you love to perform, sort of. Great joy is after you get off the stage.
Well, I love performing 1-hour shows.
Yeah, yeah.
At 67 years old, you know, I'm just gonna I try to have a real good show and then get out of there. Because this 3-set thing at bars, 4 sets is a thing of the past. That's really
what great memories you must.
They
have.
Are.
Oh, they
Their
are.
Memories
They're
are
wonderful
yeah.
memories,
especially when you recycle your audience so that you could repeat, which is what we did when we were first learning the repertoire for the folk scene. Is we, you know, we'd do 2 sets of something, and then at 2 a.m. we'd start over again.
When you two more recently perform, and I'm thinking of what I was thinking when I was listening to these Steve Goodman re-releases, and it really, they were both really evocative of a time and place, and I have to believe, John, that the people who went to the Heritage Gallery and are now going to the Givens Castle to hear these things, that they too are having these remarkable memories evoked. Now I guess you can go see John Prine at Ravinia or some bigger concert hall, but I think it still brings you back to John Prine at the Earl.
Well, it does. It really does. It brings you kind of back to that era. But, you know, these people are also extremely contemporary, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's what makes this music breathes, folk music breathes, and it keeps evolving. Michael Smith, for example,
exactly.
is still writing the best songs he's ever written now.
Yeah, that's a great. Jimmy, before I let you guys go, and again, Saturday, 7 o'clock, Givens Castle, Michael Smith, John and Julia Devins, Ann Hills, Larry Gray, Jamie O'Reilly. What's the website again?
Concertsatthecastle.org.
This is in having John do this. I'm trying to make him more self-promotional. I know what the website is, but I want you to do this.
Tickets $35, free refreshments.
I think Michael Smith should be accorded, and I think John Prine would agree, the same level of acclaim.
Well, I agree with you about that, and John and I have talked about this too. I also think the art, like John, whether John's a big promoter or not, I think the artist does have the privilege to be what it is they are. And in the case of Michael, while he understands the aspect of self-promotion, the truth is, and part of the reason we kind of love that novelist style that he has, which is that he's an internal guy who
no
does
question.
A lot of sorting, a lot of reading. And making the music is his occupation and his preoccupation.
Yeah.
So for the people that appreciate him, they recognize that the schmooze deal is not Michael. But
thank God.
Yeah. But getting on stage and giving you what he has put together means is very mindful, and it's, and again, like John said, it's very contemporary because he pays attention to the world, and then he has his own take on it. And I think that's what all artists who really want to last a lifetime need to tell themselves. You can be topical and you can, you know, be commercial, but what's going to last is your mind. And music, as we were saying, when you talk about what it revives in us, it's because music and scent, they say, are the two big things as we age that we grab hold of that bring us back to our youth. And music is viable and very important for those of us getting older to have available. And that's why we continue to do it, I think.
Well said.
It is an ongoing pleasure to know the two of you, Jamie O'Reilly and John Devins.
Thank
John,
you, Rick.
One more time, the website.
Concertsatthecastle.org.
Far out.
Thank you. Knock 'em Dead next Saturday at 7 o'clock at Givens Castle on the corner. You cannot miss it. 103rd and Longwood Drive in beautiful Beverly, the neighborhood of Beverly. It's not a suburb. It's a neighborhood. We'll take a short break and come back and talk to Melaina Evans about her first novel.
I thought I was going to do before I lost my mind. John Prine and I wrote this. We tried to put into one song everything that had ever been in any of the country songs we'd ever heard. It was all I could do to keep from crying. Sometimes it seems so useless to remain.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is from a reissue of the CD Artistic Hair, one of the last two CDs released while Steve Goodman was still alive. He died in 1984 at the incredibly tragic age of 36. He'd been suffering leukemia, mostly out of the public eye. You'll hear the rest of that throughout this show. It is my unbelievable pleasure. I mean, we have a mutual friend. And so that is the reason that when I got a book called Jagger Jones and the Mummy's Ankh, is that pronounced correctly?
Jagger Jones and the Mummy's Ankh.
Jagger Jones. When the royal family of Egypt needs saving, a boy from Chicago's South Side becomes their last hope. There was enough in the title and subtitle to intrigue me, but this is not the kind of book I normally would pick up off the bookshelf. I was charmed by this.
A lot of middle grade on your shelf, huh?
Very little middle grade on my shelf.
I'm honored.
By middle grade, I know that the weird world of publishing these days is a kind of niche and genre kind of world. Do you have to, when a young adult is probably a huge umbrella, yes?
It is. Young adult is a pretty big umbrella. Middle grade's a little smaller.
Meaning what?
It's fourth, fifth, sixth grade-ish, even though my character is 13. They're not supposed to be over 12. I'm just a rule breaker.
Your character is amazing, too. He won the state science fair in second grade. That's something I know about this book. Before we talk about the book, and I do want to, and I enjoyed this book tremendously. It's a great kind of adventure story. Not my kind of adventure story, but you hooked me. You were born and raised and stayed in all places, Utah, basically until your early 20s. I do not know anybody and have never met anybody from Utah. Why were you born there? My parents lived there. And what was that like to grow up in?
Not only am I from Utah, I'm from a tiny little town, very small, very polygamous, very homogenous, all Mormon, all white, very small. We did not have a single stop sign. So when I was in middle grade, pretty much the way I experienced the world was through books.
Yeah.
I was pretty bored of that small town pretty early.
But what access to books did you have? I mean, what sort of book? Was it free range?
Sure. My older sisters are teachers, are school teachers. Mm-hmm. And my oldest sister just gave me all the Anne McCaffrey Dragon books and Lord of the Rings and Piers Anthony Xanth novels. I read a lot of science fiction in middle grade from my older sister school teacher.
And you wound up going to high school in Utah, too, yes?
Yeah, I went to the University of Utah. My undergrad is University of Utah.
When, then, did you start writing with, and you know, everybody writes. You have to write papers, you have to do this, you write in diaries, you do all sorts of, people always, one would hope, do a lot of writing. When did you start to take it at all seriously?
You know, I have, this might be the third or fourth, possibly fifth book I've written over my life, because I just write for fun.
Yeah.
But it's the first book that I wrote and I thought, you know what, maybe I should take myself seriously. Maybe I could get this book launched into the world. None of the others were any good. And honestly, the first version of this was not any good. But
see,
at some point, I was like, maybe I'm going to
get into that, because you thank and acknowledge a number of coaches. And I'm fascinated with the notion of coach writing. But let's say in high school or college, did you... You couldn't have started to write a book, or did you write a book? I don't know.
No, I was not a particularly good student. I don't think any of my teachers ever said you were a great writer. I did win a writing competition in second grade, but...
Second grade.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean,
look,
maybe there was a little hint.
Milena spelled her name correctly.
Right. So there was that. But other than that, I don't know that anybody ever said you have... A lot of writers have a story about their teacher that told them they had great talent. Nobody was that impressed with me.
Well, maybe,
I must admit.
Maybe it says something about the Utah higher education system.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Chicago in many ways was the University of Chicago, right?
What brought me to Chicago was I didn't want to live in Utah. And I sort of just...
There, now I've gotten to the gist of the Utah lifestyle.
Right. I didn't want to, I wanted to live in a bigger city. And I was married at the time. And... I don't know. We sort of just picked Chicago as a place. Neither of us had family. We had no connections. The guy I worked for in Salt Lake City owned a radio station here.
In Chicago?
So I kind of thought he'd give me a job.
And what was his name? Do we know him? Dan? I'm looking at Dan Lawn, the engineer.
Nice guy. But all of a sudden, his name is escaping me.
That's okay. He couldn't have been a big shot then. He wasn't like Larry Word or Jim DeCastro or someone like that. And you decided to come to Chicago. What did your husband do?
He went to DePaul.
To study.
And I worked at I worked for a minute.
I know you worked here for a while.
Yeah, I worked at GN.
What do you think of these studios?
These studios are pretty swanky.
Yeah, no.
Although Michigan Avenue was nice, too. That was a pretty studio you could watch people walk past.
Dan and I agree.
Yeah.
Roe Coleman agrees.
But this is lovely.
Yeah. So, what did you do here?
Sales. When I was
in the glory
up in
days, that must have been easy. You could like stay in bed and sell commercials on WGN.
When I was growing up in my very small town, no women had jobs. There were a few school teachers, including my teacher. But my high school boyfriend picked me up in a BMW that his aunt had. And his aunt actually made the money, and she was in media sales. So when I got out of college, I was like, the only thing women can do that pays is media sales.
What inspired your career? Well, my boyfriend's aunt had a BMW, so I came to Chicago.
That's basically it.
There must have been some other reason to pick Chicago, though.
No, it was totally
really?
Random. I mean, I knew I had a job lead. We literally had like $1,200 to our name. I was 24. We packed a U-Haul, drove here. Crossed our fingers.
And you spent, and tell me I'm wrong here, you spent roughly a decade working in media in Chicago. I mean, were you working in sales for other stations?
Right. I worked for WGN and for another media company called Newswire One, and worked for WLIT for a while.
All in sales?
All in sales.
And you enjoyed that?
Loved it. Yeah, I really did like that job. I like working with clients. I'm kind of a people person.
Those were also the glory. I'm looking at Dan. Those were also the glory days of conventional radio, terrestrial radio in Chicago.
Right, before the digital thing. It was pretty creative, selling the Bears, the Cubs. It was fun.
Oh, yeah. And no offense, with all due respect, relatively easy, too, was it
probably
not?
Probably easier than it would be now,
would you like
I'm
to
sure.
be on this station? Yes, we have a 42% share.
Right.
What drew you then, Melina Evans, to to academia then? I mean, what was it, something about the nature of sales jobs, or was it something of
a larger kind of calling for you? I definitely wasn't running away from it. I liked my career. I was running to something different.
Yeah.
I think it was, in a way, all that fiction from middle grade kind of taught me that there's a lot of ways to be in the world, and the way people were in Lehi, Utah wasn't the only way to be. And that sort of led me to an interest in ancient history. So while I was working in media sales, I got a master's degree at UIC in Greek and Roman history. And there I learned that most of the things they did, they learned from the Egyptians and Mesopotamians. So I went to U of C to get my PhD.
This is an interesting thing. You get a master's in Greek and Roman history. It is, to my mind, academically and emotionally and physically and intellectually, a really huge leap from there to say, I'm going to go get a PhD in Egyptology. Maybe I'm making too much of that, but it seems like a huge leap to me.
I think more that I made too little of it. I might have been inclined several times in my life to just sort of leap off a cliff and be like, oh, sure, this will be fine.
Yeah.
So I think I was actually kind of just naive. I don't think I understood quite what I was getting into. I didn't know anybody be at the PhD. I didn't kind of like figure out what I was going to do. I was just really interested in the field. So I just
You must have. I mean, the U of C is noted for, you know, sort of decent professors. You must have had some professors there who inspired you.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. My advisor over there, Janet Johnson, who is still there, is just amazing, was kind of a trendsetter. Not a lot of women reached her level at the time she did. But yeah, I had some awesome professors.
And you did this. You got your PhD while you were having two children.
Yes.
And while you were working full time.
No, I was not working by the time. I quit. I was working at the Light when I got accepted to U of C, and I quit. I went to school full time.
Wow. How long did it take you to get your PhD?
I was there for about 10 years. You get the master's degree, you do the coursework, you do the exams, you write the dissertation from beginning to end. Now, during the dissertation phase, I went back to work, but it was probably about 10 years.
That's a remarkable story. We're going to talk of the manifestation of this career. I'm going to read you some of the, is it Jagger or Jagger?
Jagger. Like Mick Jagger.
Like Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
The 75-year-old rock star. Jagger Jones and the Mummy's Ankh. When the royal family of Egypt needs saving, a boy from Chicago's South Side becomes their last hope. It is the first of what you anticipate and are working on, a trilogy of stories.
Right.
Featuring this kid is pretty amazing. So is his sister, though. I have to tell you, so is his sister. We will be back after a short commercial break and the news with Melena Evans. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 10 o'clock on the button, and fresh from seeing his former student, Lauren Himmel.
Thank you, folks. Thank you, folks.
That is the one and only Steve Goodman. If you never heard Steve or saw Steve play, you have never seen a more ebullient performer there's never been. And one of the reasons was Steve was diagnosed with leukemia when he was very young, lived with the disease when he was 19, lived with it. So there was an urgency to his performances. He has two new CDs coming out. You can read about a Monday in the Chicago Tribune under my name. Jagger Jones and the Mummy's Ankh is a story about two kids. Put put bluntly and shortly, it's about two young kids who get thrown back 3,000 years. Is that right, Melanie
Evans?
That's
exactly right, yeah.
That's right. If she's the author, she knows this. One of the kids, Jagger, is something of a very precocious, bright young man. The one thing I'll tell you, he's bright and precocious throughout the whole book, but he also won the state science fair when he was in second grade. That's how smart he is. He travels back in time with his sister, his younger sister, Aria. I'm going to read, if it's okay with Melena, can I read a short portion of this book?
Absolutely.
Just to give people a sense of what a good writer I think you are.
Well, thank you.
They're back in ancient Egypt and blah, 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 blah. I'm going to try not to give away too much. But the urge to see what was in that room, to meet the girl who'd been calling out to him, was too strong to resist. He pushed Aria behind him, took a breath, and slipped past the rock, shining a flashlight around and gasping in awe. The room glittered with gold. By some miracle, the tomb had escaped the notice of both ancient tomb robbers and modern scholars. He'd be a hero to geeks across the globe. His breath quickened as he inched forward, trying not to step on any priceless objects. There was a chair with lion's paw feet, a gold chest, a broken chariot with gem-studded wheels, loads of gold and alabaster jugs, and more ancient knick-knacks than his brain could possess. Process. Centuries of dust couldn't hide the beauty or fortune stuffed into this small room. I love that section. As a writer, when you finally, after getting your PhD and absorbing all you could about ancient Egypt, when you sat down to write this book, did you do so with the notion that, well, it's going to be like my other books and I'll just sit down and write what comes out, or I really think I'm ready to try to get a book published?
Yes and yes. When I first wrote it, my son, who is now 16 and 6'2", was 9 years old. And he and I were sitting in Hyde Park having coffee one day, and he asked me what ancient Egyptians look like. My kids are biracial. And I told him he would make a very good ancient Egyptian. And he said, somebody should write a book about a kid who looks like me, lost in ancient Egypt. So when we started to write it, we wrote it together. He and I just kind of, we were going through a tough time as a family. It was more like a parenting exercise, kind of spending quality time with my son.
Yeah.
But when I got to the end, I liked Jagger. I liked the setting. I thought I had something unique. And so I went and found myself a local kids lit coach.
The great Esther
Hirschenhorn. Yep.
What does that mean, Melena Evans? What is, I know Esther, I've known her for quite some time and admire her. What is that? What is a writing coach?
She basically understands the business. And so for me, who knew nothing at all about the business, I literally paid her to read the first 50 pages of my initial draft. And she was great. We went to lunch and she gushed over how great it was and how fabulous. And then she sort of really nicely told me to start over it, but she gave me a bit of a roadmap. You know, she was like, this is a hero tale.
Yes, this is a wonderful book. Throw it in the garbage can and start again.
Yeah, but then she gave me a roadmap. She was like, in a hero tale, in chapter 8, the character is betrayed, and in chapter 9, you find an artifact. Like, she literally
gave
mapped
you a kind of roadmap
for hero tale
a literary roadmap
right, exactly.
for this thing.
Which I didn't know. So then when I
were you emboldened by that or frustrated?
Yeah, I was thrilled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was emboldened. I think at that point also, you know, I was at a tough time in life, and sort of to lay in bed at night and think about Jagger's problems rather than my own was actually kind of therapeutic for me. So I was happy I got to keep writing.
Well, after you met with Esther, what would your son say? Hey, Mom, how's our book coming?
Yeah.
Or have you cut me out of this deal completely?
No, the baton somewhat passed as he aged to the little sister. So she became a little more engaged, and he sort of disengaged. But we have a lot of family dinners where I'll be like, okay, here's the scene. How should we get the kids out of this situation? So they're kind of thought partners. Their creativity helps.
After this coaching from Esther Hirschenhorn, you went at this full bore?
Very intentional. I was very intentional about writing it so it could get published, Taking It the Distance. Yeah, I was very intentional about it being a trilogy. I sort of had three books in mind. Yeah, so the second time, and I was thoughtful about trying to figure out why the things I wrote weren't good enough to sort of, I kind of knew how to write, but I didn't know anything about how to edit. So I did try to kind of learn that skill a little bit. I'm not great at it still, but I'm getting better.
Well, you also write that the series, which had turned into a series, a three-book series, you write in here, many of the characters in the book are based on real people. Was that, that must have made it slightly easier for you, having a foundation from your PhD studies,
right,
upon which you could base some characters. These all didn't have to be, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I had some scaffolding, things that had to happen because they happened in history that definitely helped me put it together. I think one of the things I had to do was take history out. I was so into the history that it was sort of boring to read at first. I had to kind of edit a lot of the historical details out.
Well, you also write in here, interestingly, and to that point, I also empowered the storyteller in me to override the historian, which is a complicated way to admit I took liberties with the history currently known to us. That must have been fun for you, though. Because it's liberating, yes?
Yes. Probably the reason I didn't stay in academia was I'm just by nature a super creative person. And so this was a good fit for me. I could take the sort of pedantic things I'd learned and the details I'd kind of figured out through grad school, but I could sort of give myself free rein to have fun with it.
But you also, I mean, near the end of the book, you have a, you know, sort of pronunciation list, which which I certainly needed, but a pronunciation guide and then this historical note. I mean, it is also very important to you that this book have that historical foundation, even fictionalized with your creative.
Right. I think what was important for me was I hope that in the same way that science fiction kind of got under my bloodstream and turned to a passion for ancient history, I would love some kids to read this and really get how awesome ancient Egypt was. So for me to kind of imbue the spirit of ancient Egypt was really important. And I tried to find ways to do that that would be fun to read, kind of picking up the more imaginative parts of the culture. And, you know, kind of try to bump up the real fantastical fun stuff.
You know, I know you spent some time living in Hyde Park, and I'm wondering if you ever read that other great YA Hyde Park author, Blue Balliet.
Yes.
And know of her work.
Mm-hmm.
Because Blue is also, I mean, a great friend of mine and also a very talented writer. Did she at all inspire you?
No, but
they're vastly different things.
You know, it's funny. I didn't actually know her work until later when I was writing, and it kind of was brought to my attention. So, yeah.
Who inspires you? I mean, as a, you know, beside Esther Hirshenhorn, you know, you as a child, you said you were sort of a voracious reader. If you had, even though this book is, to my mind, there is no model that I see for this.
I would say the Rick Riordan books are somewhat like they're flipped on their head, because in Rick Riordan's books, of course, the ancient characters are coming forward. So he's modernizing ancient characters, and I'm sort of doing the opposite, putting modern characters in the past.
I like that.
But I would put Rick Riordan as somebody who I think writes really fun middle grade adventure series that have to do with ancient cultures.
See, it occurs to me now.
And also, he makes a lot of money off of it, so that'd be cool.
Well, that's the point of every author. I don't know. It was a thing, I think it was Samuel Johnson Royko used to have it on his wall, a saying that no man ever wrote except for money, or should write except for money. We got to take a little commercial break, and we'll come back and spend a little more time with Melena Evans and talking about her book, Jagger Jones and the Mummy's Ankh. It's young. Can I call it young adult?
It's middle grade, but you can.
But I enjoyed it. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
Thanks.
Hello, wait a minute. I'm going to read you another portion of it so you can get a sense of, I think you're a very stylish, capable writer, no question, artful, I would even say. We will be right back. Welcome back. We have a few more minutes with Melena Evans to talk about her book, Jagger Jones and the Mummy's Ankh. It's a under the broad umbrella of young adult fiction. It is about two kids, a brother and his younger sister, who go back to ancient Egypt and have these interesting adventures. But there's always in the book, I found, and I liked it quite a lot, you don't get too far afield, because here, early on, she's talking about a woman speaking and says the woman sounded like she'd spent her life smoking cigarettes in one of Chicago's grungiest blues bars. So you're always still tied here. Here's another short portion of the book, just to give you a sense of what a fine writer Ms. Evans is. No! Jagger's primal scream bounced around the small room. Anger at Dad for being unavailable and irresponsible. Anger at Mom for leaving him in charge all the time, making it impossible to just be a kid. Even anger at Grams and Gramps for being old. The truth was, Jagger took care of them more than they took care of him. And anger at Arya, that again is his younger sister, for needing him so much. Jagger watched after himself by the time he was 11. Why couldn't she? But along with the bile came a realization. He didn't want to protect his sister because it was his duty. She was the only other person on the planet who shared his bizarre life, who understood what it was like to bounce back and forth between Mom and Gramps and, on occasion, Dad, and not to mention whatever continent they landed on. All that occurred to him in an instant, and he knew he needed to do something. If he didn't act, he'd never forgive himself. An old Martin Luther King Jr. quote thundered through his head, "If a man has not yet discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live." Arya was worth dying for. That, dear, is some very, very nice writing.
Aw, thank you so much.
It incorporates a lot of things there. You were also inspired to write this book, not just by talking to your teenage son about, hey, let's write a book together and then I'll screw you out of the fortune that we'll make from the book. Just joking.
You just spend it on shoes.
Yeah, right. Well, don't they all? It was also inspired by an ancient blessing. What is that blessing?
That's right.
What's it mean?
After you said or wrote a pharaoh's name, there would be three signs, and they're read Ankh Uja Seneb, which means may you have life, prosperity, and health. So in this book, I kind of wanted to contrast what we think of as life, which is, you know, just their lives are in danger, with the ancient Egyptian notions of life. So rather than them having to save a princess's life, they have to save her afterlife. So I'm kind of trying to talk about these notions in broad senses and what they mean to an ancient Egyptian versus what they mean to us. And I do the same with prosperity and health in the next two books.
Did you ever think to, I have to imagine just meeting you, and I have just met you, you'd be a great teacher.
I love teaching. I'm actually going to teach a class at the UC this fall on women in the ancient world. And I have taught classes before. I like teaching. I've taught college courses. But I've been, with the book, doing a lot of classroom visits. I would visit classrooms around Chicago every single day of my life if I could. That is the funnest thing in the world.
You have a great, great, great website. It's Malena Evans, MalaynaEvans.com. And you do these speaking engagements. What has it been like? The book was formally published in May.
Right.
When people say, what do? You say, I'm an author?
Yeah, absolutely. I do say I'm an author. I'm a writer. I actually, my real life job, I'm in marketing. I do a lot of writing for clients for that. So writing has become a bigger, bigger part of my life over the years. Absolutely.
And your second book is with the publisher. This is a trilogy.
It's a trilogy.
What are the other titles?
Book two is Arya Jones and the Guardians Uja. Book three title will have the word Seneb in it. Sure. I'm sure we've quite got that nailed down.
So you do consider But you have, what is your writing schedule like, Milena? You have two teenage kids.
An 11-year-old and a 16-year-old, right.
I consider 11 teenage.
Yeah, she considers herself teenage too, so sure you two herself, would get along yeah. well.
How do you balance that?
I have gotten to be really good at jumping in and out of things. I used to have to write it in 4 or 5 hour windows. But that's in my life right now. I can't really get those so easily.
Yeah.
I've done two things. One, my daughter's a gymnast. So while she is at the gym, which is about 6 hours a week, I just turn off my Outbox, turn off my phone and write. And then on weekend mornings, my kids just know not to talk to me. Like, I'm going to the coffee machine.
The perfect model
no
for motherhood.
That's yeah, right.
The perfect modeling for 2019 motherhood.
Well,
don't talk to me.
My son's asleep, so he doesn't care. And, you know, my daughter's pretty supportive of the whole book thing. So she just.
Now, do they, though? I mean, this is a book with an older brother and a younger sister. Do they have either of them said, Mom, I don't know your kids. I don't know if your son is as smart as this as Jagger. More power to you. You won't have to go to college because I'm not sure any kid is as smart.
Right.
And again, the mother in the book is an interesting. She's a travel writer, professional travel writer.
Right.
That's why they have traveled around the world and are more sophisticated, I guess, than most children. Do your kids ever say, Mom? That's too much like me. Your mom, why are you writing about me?
No, my son could not be. He just by nature is a really appreciative, supportive kid.
He doesn't say like, Mom, have you gotten a royalty check yet?
No.
No, okay.
No, he just, you know, says thank you and what can I do? He actually wrote a blog post for my publisher. They asked him to write a little blog post. And my daughter is just, she's a terrific writer and she's a good little storyteller. So she's just kind of. You know, part of my, she's a beta reader. She writes things in the margins like, this is boring or that's lame. So.
Yeah, you don't need to pay Esther Hirshenhorn now.
Right.
You've got your own
that's
kid
right,
who's giving
her.
You the comment. Milena Evans, it's a pleasure to meet you. And it was a pleasure to read this book. Jagger Jones, like Mick Jagger, and the Mummy Zonk. It's about two kids from Chicago who go back, way back. In time, it is based a great deal on things Milena learned getting her PhD in Egyptology, but it's as most great novels are, it takes a creative leap from that foundation. So congratulations on this.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. It's been
much
fun.
It's been fun.
Awesome.
This doesn't look like the old GN.
No, it doesn't.
She's an alumnus
way more
of GN,
fun than those guys.
Of WGN in the glory days. She's met Roe Coleman and Dan Long and me, and now she thinks GN is the bomb. As they say.
I already thought that, but now I think it's
thank
even
you.
More.
Safe drive home.
Awesome,
man.
Thanks.
We got to take a commercial, then we'll get some news, and then we will relive the glory days of Chicago Live with Casey Baker and Lauren Himmel.
Mr. Coherent here. Well, here's the song we were going to play a couple of months ago about the Linkin Park Pirates, folks, and we'll sing this for him. Don Diego. Bibbidi-bobbidi. The street lamps are on in Chicago tonight, and lovers are gazing at stars.
That is, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Steve Goodman from a CD called Artistic Hair, which is being re-released this week. I'm writing about it in Tuesday's paper. It is my nostalgic treat to welcome to the show Lauren Himmel, the greatest student that Roger Badish ever had at Evanston Township High School, and Casey Baker, the legendary former producer of this very program in a different venue. Casey now lives in Los Angeles, where he is incredibly successful. Lauren still lives here, where she is doing a lot of video work about things we don't want to talk about. I love you guys, and I'm so glad you're back.
Well, besides Mr. Badish, You were also one of my early influencers.
You don't use the word teacher, though. That's interesting.
Well, I was your unofficial WGN radio intern.
The internship was not sanctioned by any
by any reputable institution.
I'm not allowed to put on my resume.
Of higher learning. It's not to be mentioned at all. The three of us worked most closely together on the now legendary, it's like, you know, being with the Mercury Theater, sort of, the now legendary Chicago Live.
It should be in the Hall of Fame Museum.
What Hall of Fame
Museum? The journalism.
The Broadcast Museum?
The Broadcast Museum.
Well, that Larry Wirt runs that. No, Larry Wirt doesn't run it anymore. Who runs that?
David Plyer.
Oh, well.
WGN?
It deserves its own because it was not radio. It barely got on. It was supposed to be on the radio.
It was.
It was. It was on the radio. I used to cut it. So it was a live stage show that the Chicago Tribune produced with
Company Man.
The Second City. I don't know if you've heard of The Second City. They're
not what they used to be, but yes, I've heard of them.
And we did a live show, every Thursday night, first at the Chicago Theater in that black box space.
Yeah, which is a cool space.
I didn't know it existed before we
Nobody
visited
did.
It for the show.
I don't even know how we found it. Theater, it's downstairs. You entered off the alley.
It was very cool.
On the south side
of
the Chicago
Theater. It was very Rick
Hogan,
I thought.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was downtown, kind of hidden.
If you looked on my Facebook or Twitter page, you saw the legendary photo of Casey Baker and Lauren Himmel, and without argument, the greatest guest we had on that show.
Was that your favorite interview?
It's certainly better than my interview with Rahm Emanuel, it was the first interview he did after he was elected mayor.
And it was a great interview, I thought.
Just to clarify for the folks listening at home, I'm just thinking about the radio audience here. We're talking about Cookie Monster.
Oh, yes.
We forgot to actually mention that.
Well, but I thought, you know, millions of people have seen
the Facebook page.
Right.
In
my Twitter feed. Yes, Cookie Monster was a great guest, but we did have...
Possibly my best guest.
As they say in the business, a great get.
A great get.
You guys, I did too. There were some incredible frustrations, but I liked working on that show. It was an interesting experiment. What did you think, Lauren Himmel?
Well, I think the best part was living and working in Cokentown on the fifth floor of the old Tribune Tower.
Yes, that condo, I understand they're selling the Cokentown. That space is the $7 million condo. It comes with that picture of the two of you and Cookie Monster blown up to 8 feet by
my
8 feet.
My smile is as big as Cookie Monster's in
photo. I know. It really is. Cokentown. I forgot all about
Cokentown.
Population 3.
It was, but we threw that show together. I mean, it was really...
There was some cool... Dennis DeYoung, acoustic.
That's right. I remember when Dennis DeYoung, who is the mastermind behind Styx and wrote most of the songs, and I'll never forget, here's how we used to operate. I said, hey, I've got Dennis DeYoung. He's willing to come down. That was also the show that Gary Meyer was on,
yes.
I think.
Yep. It was.
And they said, oh, you got Dennis DeYoung to come down? That should sell some tickets. And indeed it did. It one did. Of the few times we really sold tickets there.
We sold a lot of shows out in the downstairs.
You may be right.
Or you may be
deluded.
You gave away a lot of tickets.
Yeah, I didn't have any friends after that thing was over. But I do remember
you
Dennis.
You knew who your loyal
I do remember. Were. I do remember Dennis saying I could get Dennis and someone who was sort of in charge of this and say, well, can he bring his own keyboard? I said, wait a minute. Dennis DeYoung has sold 20 million albums. And instead of having him bring his own keyboard, how about some free parking here?
I mean, every guest I had to tell. I'm sorry, I can't cover your parking. Nor can I give
you. We should have worked this out.
Nor can I give your publicist a free ticket.
I feel like we maybe should have covered the parking out of pocket or something. We should have figured out some illicit.
Neither of you got paid well enough. And I wound up, if I'm not mistaken, going deeply in debt, buying people drinks after the
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mainly us.
You guys and all of our friends from Second City.
Yeah.
We had some great talent. T.J. Shanoff.
Great T.J. Shanoff.
Jim Carlson, who now lives near you.
Tim Baltz, who's...
Big star now. Big
AD
star.
Bryant and Cecily Strong on SNL. They got their starts on the Chicago. I mean, they got their starts at Second City.
No, but they got their start on Chicago Live.
I think we can claim
that. Lauren Michaels. I'll never forget Lauren Michaels.
I think he showed up to scout.
He came to every one of our shows.
I kept hoping. I tried to be
their
really
weekly
funny.
Weekly comedy went down in his.
My job on the show was to move the chairs between segments, and I always tried to be like as funny as I could, hoping that I'd get plucked from Chicago
that
Live.
That is a great opportunity for comedy. Is moving a big, heavy chair.
Oh, yeah. And T.J. Shanoff, he would...
The musical director.
The musical director, his best gimmick was, we'd do some dumb joke where we, you know, Rick would do a spit take, there'd be water all over the stage.
What did we call that? What did we call the time when Rick would just vamp?
Yeah, we'd have Rick vamp.
You're vamping.
I would have to vamp, because I'd go, wait, we have no guest? What do you mean? What
the guest
I do?
Was late. Actually, I only had one guest not show up.
Who was it?
Or canceled. We don't, Hannibal Buress.
Yeah. You throw him under the bus. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the reason was. Well, I did.
Probably legit. Well, so.
He's not. I don't know that.
There'd be water on the stage, and between bits, it would be my job to go out and mop the water. Like, on all fours,
were
I'd get a towel.
And...
Well, I don't know. We do a
Casey,
some sort of comedy
really,
bit.
It's really amazing that you're thriving in California now.
It is.
Not in either a prison or a mental institution.
It's astonishing.
But what I like to remember about Chicago Live was on that show that we had Cookie Monster. We also had Grant Achatz.
The great Chicago chef.
Greatest
offered,
chef.
I had to, I asked him, will you make a special dessert for Cookie Monster?
you were on a first name basis. You just called him Cookie.
Cookie. Yeah. Mr. Monster over here.
And Grant sort of reluctantly said yes. I mean, he's not like...
He's not like what you're saying is he's not like Sam Cyanis of the Billy Goat. Sure, the cookie want a monster. Yeah. Good monster want a cookie. I'll give him one.
Right. So he said, okay, I'll make him something. And then Cookie's rep told me, sorry, no, they have to be a special.
Wait, Cookie turned down Grant Achatz.
Yes,
it wasn't on his contract writer. It
wow,
means he's got very special right. cookies he requires. Understandably.
And now, but the reason why I was on the show was because the puppeteer is obviously a Chicago native. So it was always a Chicago connection.
You told
connection.
Me it was because he was fascinated with my writing.
He was also a devoted fan of Rick Kogan and Charles Osgood.
He said he owned three copies of Dr. Nightlife Chicago, and he wanted one of them autographed.
He wanted to get it signed.
Well, because she didn't tell
those
me.
Those are hard to find. You got to go on
really,
eBay.
They're really
hard.
I
they're
mean,
pricey.
One of the most
go online.
In-depth
you know what they're
interviews.
Charging for the?
What's that?
There how was much? Once one for $7,000. You can now get one for $495,000. $495. So please go online and I don't
and
get
really?
Any,
none of it. So.
I get none of it.
Yeah. Does it have like a drink stain that from your cocktail on it? Is that what?
No. Virtually every other book
can
in
I bring,
Chicago.
Can I bring
has
my copy to the
stain.
Bar with you and would you use it as a coaster for your whiskey? I feel like that.
Casey
I could
Baker,
sell that
I'd do whatever you want. We'll be back with Casey Baker and Lauren Himmel after a show and Roger Badish. Professor Roger Badish, or what do you call him? Professor?
Mr.
Oh, Mr.
Radio
Roger Badish. We'll be back momentarily. Welcome back to the resurrected Chicago Live. Casey Baker. That's Casey Baker. He has a huge
so
job in the entertainment
so
industry,
talented.
Mostly based on that.
That's right.
His ability, there's no one else alive who knows the theme.
The theme song to Chicago Live, composed by great Second City music director Jesse Case, composed it custom. He made like six different versions of it for us. It was beautiful music.
I mean, he's
the production
so impressive.
Values.
He's so impressive.
The production values were fantastic.
And
it
was
7 years ago, and I know it today.
And it, how long ago?
Seven.
How long ago?
Seven, it ended 7 years ago. It started 9 years ago.
2010 to 2012.
It ended with a huge bang with a show at Governor's State University.
I was gone
and another
by that
show,
time.
Part of that.
And another show at Ravinia in February, in the middle of February.
That's right.
yes, it was a genius. We were not the... We were just basically the talent. There were other people who were in charge of making this show happen, among
right.
them the great legendary Sarah Beardsley.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Who is now, I think she may be the president of Nicaragua or
wow.
Jamaica or something.
Well, you mentioned the genius advertising when you were reading earlier, and I just was reminded of some of
the
great marketing schemes for Chicago Live. It was to get new readership, but they would only advertise, of course,
in the Tribune.
Right.
That was, I think that was part of the genius of Chicago Live, is we want people to come to the show, which is a way for the Tribune to reach out to people.
Younger audience.
Yes, let's not We did have a show on GN.
That's right.
Who listened to that show, Casey?
You know, it
Roger,
didn't get a,
beside
Roger,
Roger
Bad, Bad did to listen to it.
Yeah.
Because he was on Friday nights.
Well, but I don't remember ever seeing you at
because
a Chicago
he was working.
Live.
I was working.
I
he
asked
had a job.
Do
you know how I found out about that you had a show? Was the placard in the middle of the Tribune lobby that none of the public could get to
right.
by the second
right.
bank?
Exactly.
The other
exactly.
place we advertise is inside
genius.
Tribune
and then
Tower.
We, you know, we decided
genius.
To invest in billboards, and I remember driving to Kentucky on 65 South, 75 miles outside Chicago, and there was a billboard. So
that's
that was
right.
really good there.
And what would it say? It said, if you're reading this billboard, you will not be able to
and
go to
Chicago. And it was like, guess we're driving 3 weeks
the wrong direction.
Ago.
Look, you guys, I had some fun
the
there.
The almanac segment, can we just
oh,
mention?
Oh, Rick, your almanac.
We don't
no,
have to do
the
that.
Genius.
Oh, a 7 to 10 minute sort of beautifully composed slice of Chicago history every
well,
year.
Well, you used
that
it.
Was,
the reason that worked was you were able to incorporate
it was like
video
a multimedia.
I pulled together the multimedia, but it would be this like piece of poetry about a single year in Chicago history.
And I still think we should make some sort of book or...
Yeah.
Do you?
Should collect
aren't you busy?
Publish it.
I have time for you, Rick.
What, aren't
always.
You busy?
I always have time for
with
you,
an
Rick.
Introduction by Professor Roger Badish.
Oh, my God. No.
What?
The end of H Hall. In,
yes, exactly. In the TV
right.
studio.
The H corridor.
Rahm Emanuel doing his first sort of live interview after being elected in 2000, whatever.
10?
It was.
11?
11.
11 was among
yeah.
the worst interviews.
No.
You liked it?
Well,
don't you remember when he said, I said to him, I said, well, Mayor Emanuel, you know, one of the great, there were two softball questions. I said, you know, the great thing is now, you know, your children will be coming back from Washington, D.C. Won't it be wonderful to have them here? I know that most people in the audience and those listening know where your kids are going to school. Why are they going there? I didn't mention the school. Softball question. He goes, none of your business.
That's right.
Well, so I remember when he walked out, he said, well, this wasn't what I expected.
Yeah. Well, and then he gave
and
me
he,
one of
and
those
then
like,
he said,
shoulder bumps.
Never see you well, again to me.
Just to be clear, the whole thing was billed as the Chicago Tribune brought to life on stage.
Right.
We wanted news. We weren't
yeah.
there. I mean, we had the Second City there, so it had this element of levity that I think guests were expecting.
Exactly.
But you got a piece of music.
It was
you
like
got
an old show that
food.
You two don't remember that Roger probably does called That Was the Week That Was.
Yes.
Which was
TW3.
A legendary
right.
television show. It should have incorporated all that. We did try to have them. We had a lot of Tribune people doing some interviews.
Some Mark, hard news segments.
Huh?
Balanced,
yeah.
Balanced
was,
with
yeah.
some great, great
We had Karen Lewis.
Yeah.
We had was, Dick Durbin. We had all
Judy
the major.
Judy Bartopinka?
Did anybody turn us down, Warren Himmel? Because you were mostly in
oh
charge.
Oh, my God.
Of
my whole life was rejected. I was like. 2 years of being rejected left and right.
And then what? What is this Admit, show?
I have a thick skin now, thank God.
What is this show? Would they ask you
right.
that?
Right. Our boss would say, get Jennifer Hudson. And I'd say, well, how?
Yeah.
We won't even pay for her parking.
Jennifer Hudson, yes, we have a 200-seat.
And what's it? Your audience? And I'd say,
well,
WGN it's mostly Radio?
Like, it's
and
mostly friends of mine, Casey's.
Yeah, that's right. The
mine,
60
Casey's,
that
and Rick's. People who we
up.
Can give free
I
tickets
I mean, but
to.
Saying all that, I have to pat myself on the back with the help of many of the Tribune writers.
Oh, yeah.
And mostly
no,
Rick.
You got
and
some
Rick
good guests.
As well.
And we knew we could always guarantee them that David Pohl would be there in case
right.
any of them had a heart attack. The greatest
exactly.
Emergency medical technician
we
in the world.
We can't get you parking, but we can get you emergency medical
yeah.
care.
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
no,
we
but only because
that's
it's only...
Saying. We cannot get you parking, but... If you have a heart attack or another medical emergency, we can get you a guy.
And right. I might be able to get you a cold cut sandwich beforehand.
If you're lucky.
We can get you a guy.
I do also want to point out, not only did we, Lauren did a great job of getting a lot of the great gets, the Cookie Monsters, the Felicia Rashads, the
right.
Greg Proops, but we also had a lot of really awesome sort of dedication to like local great
yeah.
stories.
Oh.
The great Kevin Koval and young Chicago authors.
Yeah, and a lot of people have really risen the kids these days.
Yeah, we
days.
Had kids these days. Vic
a lot
Mensa,
of great
young
music.
Vic Mensa and
well,
Nico Siegel.
What you're saying in essence is we nurtured a lot of these up-and-coming
right.
people into stardom. They had never performed
yeah.
on stage before. Muka Paza is another
right.
great
we had
example
a Chicago
of
punk marching
60.
Band.
Person
There's
marching
a,
band
a marching guitar with an amplifier on a helmet You don't see that every day.
Yeah, there was a lot of great guests. A lot of great guests. A lot, but some duds.
I'm just saying.
Who's a dud? Beside Rob.
Okay, I've got one.
It was the one show.
Well, the great Robbie Foulkes we had on a couple times. Chicago.
Well, he wasn't a dud.
No, he wasn't. But he did one segment with some children from Nettlehorst School where they sang that song, I'm Yours. And they didn't really have a chance to practice, and there was like 9-year-old girls.
We didn't do a lot.
It went
of
on for about 7 minutes because they just kept looping it, and no one knew how it ended.
Out of the theater for segments that I knew were going to sort of
that one
go
got
down
cut
quickly.
Substantially for the radio edit.
Yes,
that was a tough job that week.
But one of the great things was your parents, Lauren Himmel, were often there.
Yeah, my dad. Often or always cried during the almanac.
Oh. Yeah, I know.
And you would always insert his name somehow.
Yeah. Well, I would stare at him. I would do the auto. Because he would be in the front row and I'd do the almanac specifically to him, staring at him the entire time until he cried. And that's when I would end the almanac.
You would throw it up.
You too, Casey, you're working for Pandora Radio.
That's correct.
Which is some kind of like a subscription radio thing.
It's an internet radio company that is a direct competitor to WGN Radio. I feel like...
I'm sure it's 1,000 times better than GNR.
Not these studios, though.
We don't have studios like this, I can guarantee
you. Okay,
that.
Well, WGN wins that one.
That's
and
right.
Lauren Himmel, you're making videos independently.
Yeah, I have my own production company.
What is it called?
You have a website? BlueFaceProductions.
What's it called? .com.
BlueFaceProductions.com.
BlueFace Productions.
Because I work until I'm blue in the face for all my clients.
As you did for Chicago Life.
Right.
And Casey, you now have, and I want you to talk about your tattoo because I think it's terribly appropriate.
Yes, thank
you. I mean,
yes,
you know,
it would have been much better if it was the sign of the Chicago Theater down straight down your arm
with the Chase logo
with
on
little
it.
Tiny faces.
This reminded me of that cake that we had on Chicago.
We were on a reality show. We were on
the cake.
Cake. Something.
See how important
we went to one of the cake place like we were husband and wife.
Yeah,
making this.
We commissioned a cake, and it had a hot dog on it. It had the Tribune Tower. It had
a newspaper, and that guy went on to make my wedding cake. Of course,
that's right.
And that's
Peter Rios of Alliance Bakery.
Alliance Bakery in Chicago. I don't know if they're still open or not.
They are. Okay.
Did he go on to something bigger than that? Or
he still makes amazing
cakes. Still makes fantastic cakes.
Casey, the next time I see you, I want to see the Chicago Theater sign
tattooed.
On your... Yeah,
right,
on
we
your,
need a Chicago montage.
Yeah, he has a really cool
it's an adaptation of the Chicago flag, which, you know, I live in California now, and it's a great way to find other Chicago expats.
Tribal thing going around your
That's not
forearm.
A tribal barbed wire.
You don't think a little tattoo of Lauren's face
and
my
Rick's face and Phil Vitale's face,
Professor Baddish, the three of us.
Let's not get crazy. All right,
well we are. Well,
well I was thinking Kogan Town. Phil
what
Vitale
makes you think I don't have those? This is just the only one you can see.
Okay, turn that TV off. We're gonna take a look and find that thing. You guys, you know how much I love you both.
We love you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Incredible memories. Incredible memories. We'll be right back.